Welcome, and thank you for joining us today as we continue our second podcast series, Conquering Cancer Together. I am your host, Dr. Marianne Fragola, Chief of Wellness Services here at New York Cancer and Blood Specialists. This series is made possible thanks to a generous grant from Pfizer, who has joined us in our mission to provide world-class, patient-centered, affordable care to patients with cancer and blood disorders in their communities, close to family and friends. Throughout this series, we plan to continue to bring light on some of the current issues within community oncology. We will focus on bladder cancer today as our topic. Today, we have Dr. Louis Evento as our guest. He has a wealth of knowledge and experience in all aspects of hematology and oncology. I have personally had the pleasure of working with him, and I am thrilled to have him join me today. Welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Marianne. It's a pleasure, and I'm very excited about talking about bladder cancer and spreading news about it and how we can make people more aware.
Absolutely. Now, I know bladder cancer is one of the most common malignancies of the urinary tract. There are many risk factors. Some can include smoking, age, gender, exposure to some chemicals, race, and even some certain diabetic medications. Can you explain what some of the common first signs of bladder cancer may be, what we can be aware of, and describing some of the common symptoms?
Well, the most common symptom, universal symptom, is blood in the urine. And I know a lot of people, when they have blood in the urine, first thing they think of is possibly urinary infection. And a lot of times, the urinary infection is treated many times before one realizes that it's just more than just a urinary infection. Hence, the etiology of the bladder cancer in women is sometimes delayed because women, you know, it's very common for women to have urinary infections versus males. And women are treated for urinary infections several times before somebody realizes, wait a minute, this is too many urinary infections here. Let's investigate further. So first common sign is blood in the urine. The second most common sign is pain on urination. And that is also a sign that needs further investigation. So an early cystoscopy is indicated. But before that, one can pick up these tumor cells or abnormal cells in the urine itself. So a simple urine test will disclose whether there's any abnormal cells in there that warrants further investigation.
Sure. And just to look back at this, you know, like you said, this is a common thing. So we don't want to say that every time we see blood in the urine, it's not going to be cancer.
Absolutely. And especially with women, when there's menstruation periods or irritation or urinary tract infection, still being the most common cause for blood in the urine.
Before we get into treatments, can we look at maybe a simple overview of the stages and maybe types of bladder cancers?
Well, bladder cancer, it's either confined to the bladder or bladder cancer can be more advanced once it's outside the bladder, but I would say about 75% of cases on presentation are confined to the bladder. So that makes treating bladder cancer and curing bladder cancer very high on the list. So stage one or stage zero and one is confined to the lining of the bladder. Stage two would be into the connective tissues. Once we get into stage three, it gets a little more complicated because that's the muscle of the bladder. And that becomes important because once the tumor is in the muscle area of the bladder, it has the propensity to spread or metastasize. So muscle invasive bladder cancer is considered a very high risk cancer. And then stage four bladder cancer would be once it's outside the bladder and into other organs or into lymph nodes.
And I would think this is a team approach, correct? You're working alongside other disciplines to be able to come up with a diagnosis and a staging.
Yes, we need the help of the urologists. We have urinary surgeons, we have reconstructive surgeons, because surgery on the bladder may require reconstruction of that bladder or the construction of a neobladder if one has to go surgical route, and medical oncologist, radiation oncologist. So many specialties within oncology are involved.
And that's typically something that would then be referred to you?
Usually the medical oncologist is called upon to make the diagnosis, and then set a stage for planning to see, do we need treatment before surgery? Do we need treatment after surgery? Or do we even need surgery at all? So usually it starts with medical oncology and incorporates surgical oncology, radiation oncology.
Right. So we just said that bladder cancer can be treated multi ways, including surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, intravesical treatment, and some targeted drugs. Right. So this can be a little overwhelming. How would we go about early stages versus later stage treatment?
Well, first thing to do is once we have the evidence that there's an abnormal urinary cytology, then the next step would be to do a test called a cystoscopy, where the urologist will put a scope into the bladder and examine the bladder for evidence of the cancer. Once that's determined, then a CAT scan is done to determine how far into the bladder that tumor may go. And then once we determine that it's either superficial, then superficial treatments can be given, such as intravesical treatments where we put the chemotherapy or an immune stimulating agent like BCG into the bladder. And that may treat and cure 90% of all superficial bladder tumors. If it's more extensive, where it goes into the muscle of the bladder, as I outlined earlier, or beyond the bladder, then we need to incorporate a surgeon, radiation oncologist, and medical oncologist, because at that point, it is likely that we will need systemic treatment, right, with chemotherapy.
Right. Now, as a layman person, when you hear cystoscopy and CAT scan and probes, it's a little overwhelming. Can we talk about comfort? Like, these patients do very well. These procedures are outpatient-based, correct?
They are, for the most part. The initial screening to see if there's any abnormality in the bladder is actually done in the urologist's office, so it is an outpatient procedure. More extensive surgery, like to remove whatever tumor is in there, which is usually the first step to remove whatever tumor is in there, is then usually done in a hospital. And there may be some bleeding associated with that, so observation is warranted.
Absolutely, but patients do tolerate these things very well.
Extremely,
and that's important.
Well.
Yeah, we've done previous podcasts where we mentioned things that sound so invasive, and I always like to, you know, put forth that it sounds terrible, but most of your providers can keep people very comfortable.
Oh, absolutely, and like I said, most of it's done in the office initially.
How important is screening for bladder malignancy, and how can we be proactive in doing such?
Well, I think a doctor's visit once a year, most people go to a primary care doctor once a year. It should always include a test for urine analysis to look for red blood cells or any abnormalities in a urine analysis. It's a very simple test, and I think that doing it prior to people having any symptoms is really critical. Of course, if people have urinary symptoms, then one has to investigate further. If the doctor is comfortable that it's just a urinary infection, then the infection is treated, and that's the end of it. But it really needs to be followed, and this has to be some degree of suspicion for that we're not missing a bladder tumor.
Sure, of course. Can we talk about the difference between ethnicities and male versus female patients?
Most of the infections occur, most of bladder cancers are predominantly male, 3-1 over female, but the interesting part of that statistic is that when we do find them in females, they're usually more advanced. And I think the reason for that is that we assume females, when they present with urinary symptoms, are always treated for a bladder infection. And this can go on for many, many, many months. So there's a delay in diagnosis of a bladder cancer in females. So I think that's why females usually wind up with a higher stage versus males. In males, we say, well, why should a male get a urinary infection? And if you rule out prostate disease, then they do a more in-depth study, and then they get to a cystoscopy a lot earlier than females. Usually Caucasians, non-Hispanic Caucasians, are usually predominantly have a higher rate, followed by Hispanic Caucasians, and then African-Americans, usually lower on the risk scale. However, African-Americans unfortunately wind up with much higher stage at diagnosis, and they have a poorer outcome because of this. So there is some element there of late diagnosis.
And do tissue types vary?
Tissue histology,
yes.
You mean? Yeah, more common. The most common type of bladder cancer is a transitional cell carcinoma. And in some ethnic groups, you can get adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinomas, which are very rare. They do behave differently than transitional cell tumors, but they are as treatable. But catching them early at an early stage, 0-1, would always be a higher success rate.
Yeah, it seems to be the pattern is that early detection is going to be the best outcome.
That's
always.
That's the key.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah.
And to respect the fact that there is blood in the urine. And now we have the cytogenetic testing where we can actually pick up tumor DNA in the urine. And we can almost make a diagnosis based on a urine analysis of carcinoma in the bladder.
And that's something we didn't have years ago.
No, not as far back as 15 years ago, we didn't have this. So with the advent of DNA genomic testing and use of genetic material, we can pick up a cancer and actually diagnose it even before we put an instrument in there.
Yeah, and that segues me to my next question, which are, what are some of the newer treatments for bladder cancer and some of the newer developments?
Well, traditionally, it used to be solely chemotherapy and surgery for the stage 3 and stage 4 cancers. Stage 1 and stage 2 cancers were treated more with local therapy, being either BCG treatment or intravesical chemotherapy. So the treatment was always localized. It would be done in the urologist's office, and treatments would be fairly easy to do. But with more advanced disease now, we can use treatments using chemotherapy, and then newer therapies like immunotherapy have come into play as well. And these may actually spare a lot of people surgery and loss of bladder if we use chemotherapy with the use of immunotherapy now to actually get complete remissions with bladder cancers.
Yeah, that's amazing. And as far as response rates with immunotherapy, can you talk a little about percentages on response rates?
I think response rates have almost doubled from 30% up as high as 60% response rates. And people are now living, you know, beyond 5 years with advanced bladder cancer. And many of these patients are in complete remission, whereas they would not have been without immunotherapy backup.
Yeah, no, the strides are unbelievable. You know, like you said before, it used to be surgery and chemotherapy, and now we have all these options.
Yeah, as of maybe even 10, 15, 20 years ago, the only option was really to remove the bladder. And that's a very, very
invasive
yeah. change in life surgery for a lot of people. I mean, it's the equivalent of a colostomy bag for someone with colon cancer. They have this urostomy bag. And then we got into developing these neobladders where they can actually do a plastic reconstruction of the bladder. But then again, they still have to be self-catheterized. It's not a normal functioning bladder. But at least now the person can have some dignity and,
sure.
and be able to just self-catheterize himself.
Yeah.
But a lot of the surgery, this invasive surgery for bladder cancer has now pretty much gone away because of the advent of this newer immunotherapy treatments and also newer chemotherapy agents, which are very targeted.
Mm-hmm. And everybody wants immunotherapy in nowadays. You hear immunotherapy and they want that. But there are toxicities, just like anything else. So can we talk a little about how we support these patients in therapy?
Well, immunotherapy treatments are becoming more universal and used for a lot of cancers. We've come to respect what they can do, but we also respect the side effects. And the side effects are usually related to the GI tract, liver, and lungs. And the way immunotherapy makes our body react to the cancer and attack it and kill it, it can also cause the body to react to normal tissue as well. So the organs that can get affected would be the colon producing a colitis, the liver producing like a hepatitis-like picture, and the lungs causing a pneumonitis or inflammation. Thankfully, these areas can be treated with a drug called prednisone, and we can tamp down the immune response in those particular areas. We have to sort of reel the immune response back in again and say, whoa, you know, we annihilated the cancer, but we can't start annihilating our own tissues. So we can reel that back in. And the good news is we can control that. And we also don't see that in a lot of patients. It's maybe a side effect in about 10 or 20%. But the vast majority of patients, 75, 80%, have no issues with these collateral incidences of colitis and hepatitis and pneumonitis. But medical oncologists have become very good at using steroids to control reactions and actually producing the best anti-cancer responses that we've seen in generations.
And I'm assuming you do educate your patients, obviously, on what to look for because you want to get these side effects if they pop up. We want to catch them early enough that we can stop them with that steroid.
Absolutely. And we inform them that if they have signs of colitis or if they have signs of a cough or fever or if they notice that they have abdominal pain or their urine is dark, or their skin looks a yellow tinge, they have to call us immediately. Because the sooner we start on the steroids, the sooner we can get those side effects under control.
Mm-hmm. And I know you and I have had the pleasure of working together to minimize symptoms in many mutual patients. Do you often refer to supportive care for side effect management and we work together to treat? Tell me your feel on that.
Oh, well, we can't do this without our partners in symptom management and control. These patients are usually elderly patients and need sort of a hands-on approach day in, day out basis, daily phone calls, monitoring a temperature, monitoring the symptoms that they normally would not report to us. So we need the full input from a lot of different services.
Now talk to me a little about dose reductions. Have you ever had to do some dose reductions but still gotten effective results?
Well, usually dose reductions with immunotherapy are usually not done. It's sort of a give-all drug where we have to give the drug and sort of try to ride through the side effects. Whereas chemotherapy, which is a different mechanism, we can dose reduce those drugs according to the patient's frailty, age, performance status, and still get a good result. But with immunotherapy drugs in general, we don't really have to resort to dose reductions.
Yeah, that's great to know. And have you seen outcomes overall improve? I think just by what we've talked about, that's an easy answer, but I'd like to hear it from
yeah,
yourself.
Yeah, we've actually doubled the response rates and survival rates in the past 10 years. Now, people are out 5 years now. 60 to 75% of them are living beyond 5 years with their cancer controlled or in remission.
And with a good quality of life.
With an excellent quality of life, because at some point the immunotherapy treatments will stop and their cancer will remain in remission.
And they just undergo surveillance.
Surveillance. And the beauty of immunotherapy is that if the cancer should return in the future, it is all likelihood that we reintroduce immunotherapy again, it will have a positive response again and put the tumor back into remission.
I think that's so important for patients to know, because they get these chemo or immunotherapy holidays knowing that it's not a failure of therapy and they can go back on and successfully do well in the future.
It's an excellent long-term drug. And the beauty of it, too, is I can treat a 40-year-old healthy person and I could treat a 90-year-old frail person with the same drug and accomplish the same outcomes. So it's really a magnificent tool that we have now. And it can benefit everybody, no matter what kind of age or condition they're in.
Now, we find that bladder cancer is not often as publicized as some of the other cancers, let's say breast cancer, lung cancer. How do we alleviate stigma to that and tell people that, hey, this is treatable? This is something that we've made great improvements in, and we want to be proactive in screening, just like we do with other cancers.
Well, bladder cancer affects sexual organs, prostate, and uterine area, so it's a very sensitive private area, and people don't want to discuss issues of that, especially if it involves surgery and changes to the lifestyle, urination style, even the image of having a device there or a bag there. So it's unlike, you know, breast cancer, which is, you know, more highly publicized, lung cancer. It doesn't get the recognition because it's still pretty much an area of taboo, and a lot of people just don't want to discuss it or even want to visualize what treatment would look like. But I think, like other GYN cancers, I think it's come to light that we can make a difference early on, such as cervical cancer now with the vaccinations for the HPV virus. It took a lot of education and a lot of beyond stigma to get people vaccinated, especially at a young age. But I think eventually we can overcome the same issues with the bladder as well.
Yeah, because it's just so important. We can have people that survive these diseases.
Exactly. And we've made tremendous strides in the last 10 years. So it seems to reason that will continue to rise. And I'd like to bring up also another issue with the genetic disorders, the Lynch syndromes. These are patients that have, and I have a few of these patients, but when we think of Lynch syndrome, we think of GI cancers predominantly. But I have a couple of patients that had bladder cancer, but not only bladder cancer, but also way up into the ureter. So this thing can affect the bladder and the tube that goes to the bladder between the kidney and the bladder. So in patients who have this genetic predisposition, Lynch, we have to be very careful to also screen them for bladder cancers.
So tell me how you would screen somebody for Lynch syndrome. What would be your clue to do that?
Oh, I standardly get a urine analysis and urine cytology every visit. So if they see me every 3 months, every 6 months, I get a urine analysis. And not only that, I get a urine cytology because I want to know if there's any abnormal DNA coming out into that urine. So I also tend to use a lot of bladder ultrasounds to look for any kind of a thickening in the bladder. And with the slightest abnormality on a bladder ultrasound, we have no problem getting an MRI or CT of the whole urinary tract. So that's often an area of neglect with the Lynch people is the bladder area.
Yeah, that's a very good point to bring up.
I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, we always associate that with the colon aspect
and
the GI
breast,
stuff.
Ovary, yeah. So yeah. I think the bladder, I always have to think bladder as well with Lynch syndrome.
And what do you see as a current challenge and then future direction for both aspects?
Well, I think with immunotherapy, I think we're heading down a road where we're going to be able to vaccinate people for cancers. Now, like we vaccinate for cervical cancer prevention, we will vaccinate people for most cancers now for prevention and risk reduction. So I think that that's definitely headed in the next probably 10 to 15 years. Certainly our Lynch people with Lynch disorder, we know they have a high risk of GI cancer, colon cancer, uterine cancer, and urinary cancer. So these are probably the first people that would probably be good candidates for a vaccine. And we are headed there because we're already using antibodies, specific antibodies, to attack cancer. I might mention, too, about bispecific antibodies, which is more or less like a vaccine, an active vaccine, where we actually take an antibody and drag a T cell along to the site of where the cancer is. So basically, it's doing what a vaccine would do. But we would be able to actively immunize people to make their own bispecific, and then they'll drag that immune cell right over to where it's supposed to be and attack that cancer. So I think that's where we're headed.
And that's obviously targeted local treatment right to the cell.
Extremely targeted, yeah. Wow. And long-lasting, too, especially if you can make your own antibodies. And those T cells will be the surveillance for years to come. So that's the road we're headed down right now.
That's amazing. Dr. Avento, is there anything else you would like to add that we may not have touched on?
I think people should be aware of the tremendous opportunity that we have now to possibly eradicate cancer in the next probably 20 years, 30 years. I think that we're on the verge of that as we speak right now. But I was just at an oncology conference, and one of the older oncologists there was saying how this is a great time to be an oncologist, exciting. And 30, 40 years ago, we had five drugs. That was it.
I was just going to ask, how many years are you practicing?
40 years.
40 years. So could you believe the advancements in what we're doing now?
To see what happens in the last 40 years, it's like, I don't want to get out now because this is exciting.
I know you. I know you want to stay.
Yeah.
So. Because of all that you do for your patients and the extra mile that you always go.
Thank you. Yeah, but absolutely. It is an exciting time to be an oncologist, and I think we can help so many people.
I have an interesting question. What are your thoughts on clinical trials? Should patients be scared of that?
Well, I think clinical trials nowadays, let's digress a little bit. Clinical trials back in the 80s and 90s usually meant that you were getting an experimental drug that we didn't know, number one, would it work? Number two, what's the correct dose? Number three, am I going to get any benefit out of it? So clinical trials in the early 80s and 90s was basically a pariah because you knew you were being experimented with. And a lot of people didn't want to do it. A lot of doctors didn't want to refer their patients for that and so on. However, nowadays, with the advent of these targeted treatments and immunotherapy drugs, there's probably no question that you're getting a drug that's going to work. And there's probably no question about what that dose should be. So those first two decisions are out. So clinical trials nowadays really allows you to probably get a great drug very early on.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to bring it up. I think, you know, that was always the stigma years ago, and I agree with you. So that's why I wanted to bring that up, because these things are scary for people when they hear them.
Yeah, for example, they had a pancreatic cancer vaccine trial not too long ago. I think the trial closed, but it was open to about 20 patients, and they would take patients that just had surgery, stage one, and they gave them, instead of giving them chemotherapy, they gave them this new cancer vaccine. So that would be one that I would raise my hand and say, I want to go into that, because I know that that vaccine is regulated, it's targeted, the theory behind it is sound, and it's just a matter of what are the results going to be. Are they going to be 20%, 30%, 40% in a positive direction? So I would take my chances with those kind of numbers.
Yeah, I thought that was important to bring up, you know, to alleviate people's fears.
But trials nowadays, that would be a gift to get a drug like that so early on.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time and your expertise today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to talk about these topics and spread the truth and allow people to say not to be afraid, and to actually get out there, get tested, get treated, and we can help you, and it's not scary.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us today in our second series of Conquering Cancer Together. I hope you found it informative and enjoyed listening. We hope you tune in for more episodes of our second podcast series sponsored by Pfizer. We are also all over social media, so please find us and like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. In addition to our social media outlets, you can always find us close to home, conquering cancer together.